So I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Tuesday, February 14th, 2017, Valentine's Day and the state's birthday. So many reasons to celebrate. And so we're going to change the order on the agenda a little bit because some of those who would like to provide testimony on House Bill 2643 won't be here till later. So we'll move it to the end of our agenda and do that after we've conducted the other hearings that we have. So first we have an informational hearing on early learning workforce. And so David and Bobby,
what are you sitting here?
Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, great.
Chair Lively, committee, for the record, David Mandel, acting early learning system director. I think one day I'll just try a different name. Just
That's right, to see if anybody's listening. Huh?
Bobby, I'm Chair Lively and members of the committee. I'm Bobby Weber from Oregon State University.
Thank you for being here.
It's really my huge pleasure to be up here with Bobby Weber, not only is she a member of the Early Learning Council, I can't go to a national meeting where someone doesn't say, and you get to work with Bobby.
Uh-oh.
So we're really lucky to have one of the national experts on child care subsidies in our state. Before I hand things over to Bobby and really want to give her most of the time today, I just wanted to also set up a little bit of the context for today's conversation on the early learning workforce. I think one of the really exciting things to see over the last few years is I think there's been a growing, not only has there been a growing understanding of the value and the importance of early learning investments in putting children on the right track for success in school and life, but I think just a stronger recognition that you can't invest in children without investing in the adults who actually work with children, and that's really the heart of this work. At the same time that it's really exciting to see that new focus, it's also an area where we have so much work to do, where just even the basic levels of salary in this field compared to K through 12, the gaps are huge, where the opportunities for accessing coaching or professional development or a pathway to a degree are often quite limited. And then we also just have a tremendously diverse workforce that we want to support, not only diverse in its racial and ethnic background, but also diverse in the settings in which people work in the early learning workforce, everything from more formal school settings to informal family child care. Really excited, though, to have a piece of legislation, SB 182, that helps address this. This is part of the bigger Council on Educator Advancement Bill, but there's also a section recognizing the needs to invest in the early learning workforce. And the governor's budget has also included about $7.5 million focused on building out those supports, both at the community level and those pathways. So just wanted to put that on the table as part of the context for this conversation. SB 182 had its first hearing last week in Senate Education, and I think has a work session coming up. But with that, I will hand it over to Bobby.
Thank you. So First, I better learn how to use it. Good. Learn to use the clicker. Two things. I want to start with a context of a little bit on the basics of the system, because you can't really understand this workforce without knowing the system that they're a part of. So I'll go briefly through that and then focus on what we know about the early learning workforce. So I'll start with children themselves, and then I want to spend a little bit of time on financing, because David already has what, I'm just going to use this, maybe. For some reason, the menu is up. Can you help me? I'm going to spend a little bit of time on financing because they wages is such a big issue. And because the whole system depends on the, to a great extent, on the system of financing that we are using. So I am going to talk about that and then get into the characteristics of the workforce and professional development. So how many children are there? Child care, we think of serving children between 0 and 12, and there's 623 Oregon children in that age group. They're really distributed pretty evenly across the age groups. What we've broken out here, though, is child care relevant age groups, because the care of babies 0 until they're 3 is very different than 3 and 4-year-olds, and then the school age. Parents think quite differently about their children before they're 9 than they do between 9 and 12. So these are the age groups to show you just how many children we're talking about. Diversity, as I'm sure you're already aware, when you compare our children to the rest of the adult population in Oregon, it's pretty obvious that we are becoming much more diverse, and that's going to have implications for the workforce. So we have almost 40% of our children are either Hispanic or non-white, non-Hispanic. So now, where are they? I just was part of a national panel on national statistics on child care, and it's amazing how close Oregon is to the national picture. About 40% of kids, no matter what age, so the children in red, those are kids who aren't in any form of non-parental care. Some of those parents may be employed. They may be taking care of the children while they work, or more commonly, they work different schedules. Somebody works at night, somebody works on weekends, but they can avoid the cost of child care, or they may just not want to put their children in care other than themselves. But about 40%. But then look at the big difference. The purple is organized care. It's by far the most commonly used for 3 and 4-year-olds. And that's, I think, because as a culture, we're increasingly aware that a child who arrives at kindergarten without that preschool group experience is going to have a harder time in kindergarten than the children who do have it. So parents, if they can at all, try very hard to get their 3 and 4-year-olds. And as a culture, we tend to keep our babies in less organized experiences, but that may also be because the cost of infant and toddler care is so outrageously high. I shouldn't say outrageous. It is just very high.
No, it's okay.
Most families cannot. I shouldn't have added the adjective, but anyway, it is.
Yes, you should.
So we end up with about 100-and-some slots. Now, remember, we had 600-and-some-thousand children, but then when you look at what families are doing, then this is what you get. So we have about 17 slots for every 100 children in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Back in the around 98, 2000, we had 22 slots for every 100 children. But the economic forces are forcing families out of organized care. They simply can't afford to stay in it. So now what we have are about 17 visible slots for every 100 children. So the financing explains a lot of what we see. It's a major issue for families. And this usually helps people see why it's such a big issue. When you compare the cost of tuition in a the median cost of tuition in a university to the median cost of toddler care, you can see how much greater the cost of child care is than university tuition.
Thank you, Chair, and it's fabulous to see you, Bobby.
Thank you.
Do you know what the cost of community college average tuition is?
No, but I should put it in.
I think it's significantly less.
I'll add that. Mm-hmm.
And it's always been an interesting issue to me because there's been a lot of impetus in trying to support tuition relief at community colleges, which I support. But then you look at it compared to early childhood and... It speaks to our lack of investment in that arena.
Yeah. I'll look it up, but I hope they're posted on the website. I bet they are. So this amount represents 62% of a median wage earner's annual income. Obviously, they're not paying for group care on those kind of wages. But it's important to note, parents don't always pay the price, and that surprises people. I think of the American family as one of the most clever, resilient group of people. They find ways to do what they believe they need to do for their children, and that may often include buying a little bit of care, getting grandma to do a couple days, changing their own work schedules so that one or two of them can do another day. So these are truly the prices, but it's important to realize that what parents pay is not always the full price. It is for some people, but parents try really hard to manage such a high cost burden. So part of the story, and I don't know if you've heard, but Oregon ranks very high on unaffordability, like in the top five. But that isn't just because of child care prices. We also have below average median wages. So wages were falling. They've now stabilized, but they're not moving much. So this is household income, not wages, excuse me. So what you can see, and look at the difference for a single parent and for couples and all households, that single parents are at a female single parents are at a great disadvantage. At the same time, child care prices have had to increase. So the affordability crisis that we hear so much about is not just prices. It's that the incomes are not moving, or they're moving now, finally, the right direction. They were going down. While prices were going up, we had incomes going down. Now incomes are stabilizing. And interestingly enough, the prices have to go up as demand goes down and providers have to do what they need to stay in business. They have to increase prices. So it's a combination, and it's important, I think, to realize that childcare prices go in sync with housing prices. We don't know why, but the correlation is 0.85 in Oregon. So there's this high association between the two. So for Oregon families, young families with children, they're hit with higher than average housing prices, in relationship to their income, child care prices. And I can't believe that doesn't explain part of the reason for our hunger being in the top ranks also. If families have to spend this much on these two basics, what does that leave for food? So it is a big strain on Oregon families. The people often assume then the providers are doing well. About 80% of child care prices expenditures in a center are linked to personnel. And the we are paying center teachers from the median ranges from $20 an hour to $30 an hour, and they almost half of them have bachelor's degrees. So I think it would be we'd be very hard pressed to make the case that we are overpaying, and 80% of the cost is in those salaries. And typically, centers offer with less than a 3% profit range. So we can't explain high prices by thinking that maybe this sector is making over profits or incomes beyond what we think is reasonable. In fact, I think almost anybody would think what we're paying the early learning workforce to be not reasonable. So for the it's a slightly different picture for family child care. They charge significantly smaller prices, lower prices, but they work really long hours. The National Survey of Early Care and Education documents that they average 57 hours a week working directly with children, and on top of that, they average another 14 hours doing the work, grocery shopping, repairing toys, making, you know, whatever they need to do to run their business. And about a quarter of them have a bachelor's or higher. So the financing of this system is certainly a big part of this story. Three quarters of the money that finances this entire system comes directly from parents. So we don't run any of our other systems on the back of the families who use the service. We pay for K-12. We pay a huge share of higher ed. But in these early years where the science is very, very strong, that we have the biggest return on our investment, we are putting a very limited amount. And when you look at the public investments that we do make, by the state and by the federal government, 80% of that is tax credits. So that's not going to providers directly. What that is predominantly doing is helping parents with the cost burden, but I don't know if you're following. There's a lot of national movement on improving the child care tax credits. They don't work. The national ones do not work for low-income families, and unless they're refundable, they won't. And because they don't have a big enough tax burden to have the credit offset it. Oregon. We are refundable, so we can be quite proud of our tax credit. The issue there is not enough families seem to be aware, and it would be great to have a campaign to help them. So we're the public puts a very limited amount of money into a system that is really quite expensive to run. But when you consider the number of children it's serving and the number of people who work in the workforce, that is not surprising the size of the investment. So,
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Bobby, have you been able to identify the reason why parents seem maybe not to know about it? Is it tax preparation, and with more people doing online tax preparation, maybe those programs don't notify an Oregonian of that? Or what, I mean, how can they miss that?
I wish I knew. I think maybe ownership of the campaign to educate parents hasn't landed somewhere. And if somebody, Representative Kinnegar? Did you want to?
You should finish your sentence, but I have a response as well.
If somebody owned the campaign to educate parents, right now it's a responsibility for all of us, and I think it's so diffuse that nobody really claims it and builds a strong campaign.
Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. We did a lot of work on the child care tax credits, combining what used to be called the working family child care tax credit and the child and dependent CDC, child and dependent care tax credit into one that was more usable for low income and refundable. So we did a lot of work on that last year, which is great. But you're right, the uptake, I'm not sure what it is for that. I do know that our uptake for the EITC is the lowest in the nation. We're dead last. We did have a bill that was trying to get at doing a task force, and DHS was going through a lot of changes at the time. They had too many things on their bucket list, but it's something that I'm keenly aware of, and I think you're right that there has to be kind of an agency that's held responsible for making sure that we get the word out, and it would seem to be DHS because they're the ones that do the ERDC program and TANF and all these kinds of programs. So it is something that we're very aware of in Human Services, and Representative Hayden and I worked a lot on this issue in the past, and we'd be happy to tell, maybe do a panel on it at some point. But,
I won't go a lot into the public programs, but we're just not reaching all the kids. With our subsidy program, we're serving 18% of the eligible children. Head Start and Preschool Promise are reaching 62%, Early Head Start 37%. So we're, even when you, Early Head Start, I'm sorry, is 8%. It's 37% when you go up to the 200%, which we can do for Preschool Promise. But this is even of the very low-income children that we're talking about. And we don't begin to even touch that working low-wage working group that's right above the very low income. So the workforce, I need to go fast. It's bigger, much bigger than people think it is. It's comparable to the wood.
No need to rush.
Oh, okay. To the wood products industry, and real estate, and because it's not very visible, people don't realize how big it is. So they work, as David said, in diverse settings, and they themselves are diverse. They are more diverse than the general population of Oregon, and if you notice, the small home-based providers are the most diverse of all. So that's where we're most likely to see the Hispanic, Russian, Somali children being cared for in small home-based settings. Education also varies by type of care. You can see now the column I'm showing is all the staff in a center who work directly with young children. And so then it's only 40%. When we look just at the classroom teachers, not including their aides, then it got close to 50% had a bachelor's. But when you look at everybody, then you can see. And I think that group that has less than a high school diploma in or a GED is the most substantial in that small home-based care. That is related to that diversity that I just pointed out. So these are people without degrees here in the U.S. Retention is a huge issue in this field, and we care about it. It matters. Every time a teacher leaves, a child has had their adult-child relationship broken. So the retention is an issue for all kinds of reasons, but probably the one we care the most about is its impact on children. The instability it brings into the lives of children, because that adult-child relationship is the most important thing that a child has, and the younger the child, the more important the stability of that relationship. So to have this high level of instability, so what we find is that the 76%, if we just look from 1 year to the next, we about 76% stay. But if we look over 2 years, only 65% stay. So, and we want to do more studies to look at this, but we're not retaining people in this workforce. Although it does appear, this is the kind of question we want to answer, who's staying and who's leaving? We already know that those workforce members who participate in professional development are more likely to be in the group that stays. And so other thing that's really important is we can see an association between lower retention rates and lower wages that the center pays. And there's a K-12 study that shows very strongly that when you pay lower wages, you have higher turnover rate. Not surprising, but and the our turnover rate of 76% compares to the 92% for K-12. That's a national, not Oregon, but we don't have an Oregon retention number to compare it to. So one of the most controversial questions, and I'm sure you've participated in the conversation, is do these teachers need a bachelor's degree? We know for sure that education and training are associated with more positive teacher behaviors and stronger positive child outcomes. There is no question about that research. Early research showed an association between the bachelor's and child outcomes. But later research indicates that the picture is not that clear. And we simply, at this point in time, don't know how much education is necessary to get the child outcomes. So we don't know that sweet spot that says if they have this much, then we can count on having more positive child outcomes. On another study we did validating the SPARC, the state's quality rating, we did find that there were points at which above that, at that level or higher, they got higher scores on a measure of observed quality of the interaction between the child and the adult. So we know there's a spot. We don't know exactly where the spot is. So we know it matters. There isn't any question that education and training make a difference. But what we don't know is exactly how much we need to have. The other thing that's very important about this workforce is they kind of do it backward. It's common for someone to enter this field without education or training in it, and then get in it and find out that they absolutely love this work, and then start picking up the courses and the training events that they need to give them the skill. So it's even amongst that bachelor degree group that we've referred to, they often do not have their bachelor's in early childhood. So for them, then it's a requirement of picking up the early childhood content in order to have the competence that they need to do this work. But of course, as you saw, there were huge numbers that had no degrees or formal training. 20% of the workforce has no degree beyond high school, but has some college, a certificate, or a foreign degree. So that some college group is an important group for us. 13% have an associate degree, and annual training ranges from 14 to 28 hours annually. They are required, depending on the type of care. They do have some training requirements. They are exceeding the required training levels, though. Hmm. They are actually getting more training than they're required to have. So what are their needs? Children benefit from teachers who understand their culture and speak their language. That the research is pretty clear on the importance of acceptance on the child's part, acceptance of their culture, acceptance of their language. So we need to increase access for targeted populations to professional development in order to both keep those we have, bring more in, and get the skill set to the group of people who's working with some of the children who have the highest needs. But a number of barriers prevent the workforce from participating in professional development, not the least of which is the salaries they're getting paid. Out of that, to pay for college coursework and the hours they're working. So there are numerous barriers. And what a project that the state has been involved in for the last about 4 years, we've documented the importance of the role of navigators in helping these people address language issues, barriers, even finding the kinds of professional development that will fit with the kind of work schedule you have. That isn't just obvious how somebody who works the kind of hours the home-based providers work, then when do they get education and training? I was on a call with some Oregon professional development folks the other day, and there was a group who found great success offering training during nap time. So, you know, I think it's that kind of responsiveness to the challenges that these people face that will make us successful in increasing the skills of this workforce, which is critical because, as David said, the well-being of our children is tied to that skill level more than anything else. Pathways to certificates and degrees are often blocked. We do not make it easy for somebody to pick up training and coursework here and there and then end up having that contribute to the receipt of achievement of a degree, a certificate, or a degree. And so it is really important that higher education, the resource and referral system that works directly with this workforce, and others develop a system of portable, stackable professional development units so that once I invest in myself, that's going to be recognized as I move forward. And I'm going to keep building on it. Right now, it's a lot of false starts. It's very difficult for these people to get degrees. True. And low wages, as I've already mentioned, are associated with low retention and thus increased instability for children. We need
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the recognition of foreign degrees.
Uh-huh.
And it was maybe if you could go back a slide.
Uh-huh.
It was included as if it was equivalent to not having a high school diploma and having some college. And so
it gets included in the count along
but
with other college coursework. That's right.
So, if I may, I'm always an advocate for acknowledging the work that people have put into their own professional development. And since this is generally targeted at women, I want to make sure that we as a state are removing all barriers to people's professional development wherever they obtained it, making sure that that pays off for them. And so I'm going to challenge and push to say that there's an opportunity for us to make sure that those foreign degrees are acknowledged and respected appropriately as we, you know, try to engage people in the workforce fairly and equitably.
Over the years, the Oregon Community Foundation, through its investment in professional development, has had a fund that has allowed the Career Development Center in Childhood Care and Education at Portland State to actually work with these people to get their foreign degrees recognized. I would need to find out the status of that program right now. But there's full agreement with you that if you have a degree from somewhere else, we need to find a way to recognize it.
Thank you.
And I'll look at why we put it in that category. That's a really important question, and so I'm going to look at why we put it there.
I think it's a degree from U of O.
I second that.
There we go.
If OSU did the study, that's got to be the answer.
It's got to be the answer.
One thing I just want to add in this conversation is I think one of the great opportunities I'm seeing at the moment is, you know, a lot of this information that Bobby has been sharing with you has in some sense been a sort of early childhood conversation, and I think we're having an opportunity in elevating the needs of the early learning workforce to have a different kind of conversation with our partners in higher ed to also make sure that our higher education institutions understand and are meeting the needs of this workforce. So I think that's an opportunity that we as a state haven't fully cashed in on yet, but I think is a real potential.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
a serious question or comment this time. Where do community colleges, I know community colleges don't give baccalaureate degrees, but where do they fit into the spectrum of preparing?
They're the part of higher education that is the strongest for early childhood. We did have the early childhood programs in all 17 colleges. We don't right now, but in most of them.
That's where I was getting to. Okay.
In most of them we do, and they work well together, and they oftentimes work very closely with their child care resource and referral agencies. I think in five, those are the community-based organizations that work directly with this workforce. And I think in five of the cases, the community college actually hosts the child care resource and referral, which then facilitates the training being moved easily into the the work that will be recognized for certificates and degrees. I'd say the bigger problem is once they want to move towards the BA. That's much more challenging. The community college system is very responsive, offers courses oftentimes at times that they can come in the evenings or the weekends, works very hard to be sure their curricula is tied to the needs of this workforce. The issue is far greater at the four-year schools.
And the one thing I would add on this is that I would say as a general practice for the early learning workforce, for those who receive a four-year degree, it's usually not a substitute for a two-year degree. It's through the two-year degree as part of that pathway. So this question of pathways becomes really important.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's so many issues. Like the community college offers that degree is heavy in coursework in early childhood. The bachelor's degree, part of the reason a bachelor's degree doesn't show up in the research as having an impact is a bachelor's in early childhood could be one or two classes at some universities. To get depth in this content area, you're far more likely to get it at the community college level. And you know, there are a lot of really promising ideas about partnerships between higher ed, both community colleges and the four-year schools, that takes advantage of that and makes it easy for people who get the content. They tend to want the content heavy. These are people who have already decided this is what they want to do, and they want to be good at it. And so they like the taking most of their courses in how to work with children, but there's not much space for that kind of coursework in the four-year degree requirements. So we're looking for, and David's had some great conversations. I think we're at, you know, a real potential to have some breakthroughs and to do things differently.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I had a number of concerns around the bill where we passed to require the baccalaureate degree, and you've shared a lot of the reasons for my concerns. I made the comment back then that, you know, maybe in certain circumstances, an associate's degree that was targeted mm-hmm. to the early learning might be adequate. But again, is the availability issue, particularly in rural Oregon, for people to meet the standards of the new requirements, knowing that community colleges are more plentiful, although we do have some open campus work going on and whatnot. But then I was going to ask a question about online learning capability and how are we addressing that. But then you said something else that actually brought me back more to the alignment question, which has been one of my big things the last 10 years, is how are we doing the alignment? So, David, who is working on the alignment of these programs so that if we are going to require a certain level of education and programmatic learning, who is making sure that they can actually do that with the pathway starting out in community college, which a lot of them will likely do, particularly in rural areas, but not exclusively, but right. Oftentimes they start out in community colleges. We need to make sure that they don't get trapped, I guess.
Completely agree, and I'll just sort of give my opinion on this issue of where we are. I think a tremendous amount of work in that pathway work has been done at the sort of individual level of individual community colleges, sort of working with, you know, one or two four-year institutions on building those individual pathways. I think that work has gotten as far as it can go without some state-level leadership. I've had some really great conversations with Ben Cannon at HEC about starting to figure out how we get that conversation moving. So I don't think it's quite happened, but we're having those preliminary conversations about making that happen. So I think that's where it stands at this point.
In online coursework, the community colleges have worked together, and there are online, the whole ECE degrees available. And they have I haven't kept up with it, but they have had a system that you could take your courses at different community colleges, and then they would still contribute toward getting a degree from one of the colleges. So they're doing some very substantial work.
Mr. Chair, maybe we could request an informational hearing and bring in Ben and or others to give mm-hmm. me a little more assurance that work is being done on the alignment so that we can accomplish the goals.
Sure. I think that's valid. We'll put that on our list. Okay.
And just to be honest, I would say we're at the point of starting the conversations about needing to do that work rather than doing the work. It's just the honest answer
we'll
of where
the
it stands.
And David, I understood that, and that's why
he has to bring him in here.
That's right. I had a meeting earlier this morning. I said we can use a 30-ounce hammer, or we can use a finish hammer, whatever's needed. If we're going to pass laws and requirements in this building, then it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we follow through and make sure that things are being aligned.
Absolutely.
It'll actually work in practice.
Oh, that's great. So is there anything further we need to wrap up and move on?
No.
You ran out of slides, huh?
all that's left... we were finishing on compensation. That's a huge issue. If you want any of the materials, you can email me. I'm always happy to send materials.
Great. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay, thank you. I had two quick questions. One was a BA versus an AA versus something else. I'm sure you're looking at a BA in the area of early childhood or something related. So just curious about how you're disaggregating that and trying to look at, is there any more positive association between good outcomes for a workforce and various degrees?
Well...
It's just a BA engineering.
The research on the bachelor's is really problematic because the data sets don't tell us enough about how many hours they've had of early childhood, just that they got it in that field. But the research showing that people who have taken coursework in early childhood having more positive behavior with children and those children having more positive outcomes. That is very clear. There's no question about that. So part of the problem is that there is no standard for a university to put the name early childhood on a degree. Right. But for it to have real impact, it does need to have the people in the field are very clear. They need to have a solid curriculum, and they need to have a time working directly with children that has been monitored and working, for instance, in a lab school in which the student is observed working. And there's no question but that's necessary if we're going to turn out people who can do this work.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up?
Sure.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about competency-based assessments, not just a degree or hours in the seat or whatever. So I'm just curious about whether any of this workforce training people are talking about. Some also Representative Huffman, I'm getting that I'm guessing that you were probably getting at some of the barriers for rural populations in terms of how much can this be done with supervision.
We have a competency-based degree called the Child Development Associate. It's predominantly used by Head Start. The research is pretty darn good on a CDA having an impact on behavior and changing child outcome and having some indication of changing positive outcomes. It would be below an associate degree if you were ranking them. The other thing, though, Representative, that seems important is that we have at Portland State University the Center for Career Development and Childhood Care and Education, and that is very linked to the CDA in the sense that the same competency areas, and we do have a system by which people show competency in those areas and through training and or coursework, either one, and they move on steps.
Right.
And so I think our field is pretty ready to use competency-based that is complementary with higher education, not opposed to it, but accepts the other routes that people use to get this knowledge and skill.
Yeah, great.
Great.
One more question, if we have time. I brought this up last time about substitute pools and how that's such a hard thing in the childcare especially if you have home-based childcare and one person or maybe two people offering it and somebody gets sick. So this has been a long discussion for many years, but I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts or if you know anything that's being developed, because certainly that's a huge barrier to quality care. It's a huge challenge for the workforce when there's no organized substitute pool.
The substitute pools nationally have not been very successful or here. What are been proving more successful are networks of providers where the providers know one another and they can work together to find ways to take care of needs like needing to be gone for not just illness but for training or other reasons. I think there's a lot of promise. Oregon has a number of funded networks to of targeted groups of providers that we want to be sure have opportunities to increase skills. And that's a really promising strategy. We don't have enough. It takes... it's not a big investment, but we don't have funding to do them. But it takes a highly skilled mentor, monitor, coach who staffs the network. There's research that shows unless it's staffed, it doesn't change outcomes. But a staff network that coaches these people individually, helps them teach one another, helps them deal with issues like absenteeism. Those have been shown by research to be very effective in improving quality.
Okay.
It's not a big investment.
Thank you very much. Obviously, there's more to learn about this, isn't there?
Yeah, boy, I guess so.
So I'm going to close the informational hearing on early learning workforce, and I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Health Authority's early child health programs, nurse home visiting programs, and coordinated care organizations. Kate, for a repeat appearance.
Repeat appearance.
Welcome.
Thank you. All right. Chair Lively and members of the committee, I'm Kate Wilcox, Maternal and Child Health Section Manager, Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And given the lead that I had last week, I'm going to start with a little treat.
Okay.
The first 1,000 days are important, you see. It starts before pregnancy and goes until 3. The brain grows fast, the neurons connecting, from chronic disease and obesity protecting. With good nutrition and supportive social determinants, our children and families can make lifelong health permanent. I will now share how Oregon's health authority is striving so our youngest Oregonians and their families can all be thriving.
Very good.
Yay.
Thank you.
Very good. And I have my daughter's Valentine in my pocket. So, because we approach child health in a more holistic way, starting before pregnancy and all the way through, there's a lot going on in the Oregon Health Authority. So, rather than try to cover it all, I'm going to do a couple of major groups, and then you all can dig down deeper as you'd like. The three areas that have significant impact are nutrition, our health systems alignment, and social determinants of health. And then I'll end with some sharing of the linkages between the CCOs and the early learning hubs. So good nutrition, physical activity are critically important for pregnant women, infants, toddlers, and young children whose bodies and brains are rapidly growing and developing. So the absence of those key nutrients can disrupt proper cognitive development and the building of neural connections. Nutrition, cognitive stimulation, and physical activity promote self-regulation and learning and set the stage for lifelong health. In 2013-15, 16% of our Oregon households with children experienced food insecurity, and nearly 7 experienced very low food insecurity. So food insecurity means not having enough access to food to be active and healthy. Oregon, unfortunately, is the only state in the country that experienced a statistically significant percentage increase in food insecurity in 2015 and has the 6th highest rate in the country. Unfortunately, only 40% of our toddlers regularly consume a vegetable, and the French fry is the most commonly consumed vegetable. OHA's Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, also known as WIC, serves nearly 212,000 low-income pregnant women and children each biennium with healthy foods, nutrition education, breastfeeding promotion and support, and referral services. Likewise, Oregon's Title V Maternal and Child Health Block Grant Program focuses on well women care, breastfeeding, food insecurity, physical activity and child care, and supports to local public health departments and tribes to implement evidence-based strategies to address these issues. Our health system alignment is also very important. When physical, oral, and developmental health needs are identified and treated early, such as hearing, speech, and other skills, providers can support families with services and supports to help children develop language, communication, social and emotional skills, and be on track with their peers. Additionally, a healthy child has the opportunity to play with other children, read with family members, and have regular dental and doctor visits that include developmental screenings and follow-up if needed. During 2014 to 15, only 34% of Medicaid children 0 to 5 received any dental or oral health care, and only 27 received a preventive dental service. So Oregon's health system transformation and integration of behavioral health and oral health into the coordinated care model is helping to increase these rates, as are several other programs, such as the dental sealant rate, which hits a little bit higher age group, but it's still part of that continuum of care. OHA also supports child health through immunization programs, newborn hearing and metabolic screening, and child health monitoring, assessment, and policy development. And you may have been familiar with the PRAMS, which is the Pregnancy Risk Assessment and Monitoring System. It's an ongoing survey that we provide for pregnant women, and then we do a two-year follow-back survey on those same families to find out what it's been like with a two-year-old. And in our search social determinants, we know that safe and stable housing, supportive and protective caregivers, and access to clean air and active playtime are just a few of the foundational elements for children's health. So discrimination, violence, and toxic stress have negative effects on health for everyone. Assuring children are free from adversities such as these contributes to lifelong health and positive outcomes for both the individuals and our communities. Toxic stress, trauma, and adversity, including historical trauma, adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and or adverse peer, school, and adult experience, influences the biology of health and the development, resulting in multiple mental, physical, relational, and productivity problems throughout the lifespan. In 2015, 44% of Oregonians reported having two or more ACEs, and 22% of Oregonians reported having four or more ACEs on a scale of 10. Having four or more ACEs is strongly correlated with a wide range of negative outcomes later in life, including increased risk for heart disease, cancer, kidney disease, asthma, depression, and obesity. Stable, responsive relationships and secure attachments in early childhood, meaningful peer and adult relationships for children and adolescents, and social supports and connection to communities, culture, and spirituality for adults can help build resiliency and buffer the effects of these adverse and trauma. OHA has key initiatives focused on early childhood mental health and access to services, including the expansion of the parent-child interaction therapy and the child-parent psychotherapy program. The parent-child interaction therapy program served 2,423 unique dyad families from January 2014 to June 2016, and 87% of those showed improvement. Since 2014, 65 mental health clinicians have engaged in the child parent psychotherapy training program. So we're trying to make improvements both on the provider side and for the parent-child relationships, the prevention of ACEs and toxic stress, and building that resiliency into communities. One of our strongest programs towards this end, we touched on last week, was the nurse home visiting programs. They play a key role in helping families rise above adversity and set themselves and their children on a trajectory for health and well-being. Oregon Health Authority's public health nurse home visiting programs serve over 15,000 vulnerable children, families, and children and youth with special health needs each biennium. The state's $1.5 million investment is used to provide programmatic support at the state level and as targeted case management Medicaid match at the local level. Combining the state funds with the local funds that counties put together, Oregon draws down an additional $12 million of federal Medicaid funding that serves 10,000 of those 15,000 families. You heard a little bit about the Babies First, Nurse Family Partnership, Cocoon, and Maternity Case Management programs last week. They're part of the fabric of the home visiting system. They also leverage these federal dollars and promote best practices to support these families. They also provide some gap filling for other services that are too full, such as early intervention. And the majority of these activities also support many of the CCO metrics that the CCOs are being held accountable to. We work a lot with families on alcohol and substance misuse, encourage childhood immunization, decrease cigarette smoking, work on depression screening, developmental screening, help women find effective contraception, ensure they're engaged with a primary care provider, and ensure timeliness of prenatal care. So it's a pretty effective program. It plays a real critical role in strengthening the protective factors and assuring the safe and nurturing relationships for our families. And finally, I just want to touch a minute on the collaboration and linkages between CCOs and the early learning hubs. OHA supports this critical linkage with the goals of improving the outcomes for these young children and their families. The early learning hubs and the CCOs are working collaboratively in every region. However, the partnerships look really different from region to region, depending on the structures and the shared initiatives and their relationships. Currently, the CCOs and the hubs share two metrics, the percentage of children receiving developmental screening and children receiving six or more well-child visits by the age of 15 months. So we're seeing some stronger ties there. At the state level, the Health Authority Innovator Agents and the Early Learning Division Hub Facilitators collaborate wherever they're able to. We also have a lot of cross-staffing on different projects between the Maternal and Child Health Section and the Early Learning Division. And we try to share resources as best we can across the two systems. We encourage the collaboration. We are about to put forward a collaboration handbook that outlines how some of these collaborative efforts have happened at the local level. Some other ways of collaborating, the director of the Oregon Health Authority sits on the Early Learning Council, which helps with that crossover work. And we also collaborate with each other on different grant opportunities. So there are several challenges to the hub and the CCO collaboration. There's lack of shared geography. In some of the regions, they have different incentives and contractual structures. But that said, numerous communities have developed robust shared work plans and shared initiatives and effective cross-representation on their various governance bodies. So, in summary, there's much more to be heard, but I fear that your eyes may already be blurred. I thank you for letting me share today, and to our children and families, I say hip hip hooray.
So, what questions do members have? Person Kagan.
Sorry, so many questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was a brilliant start, finish, and in between.
I fear the in between was a little more boring.
No, it wasn't at all. And thank you for putting all this in OLIS, because I was trying to grasp the numbers. So I am particularly concerned. I share a big passion with Representative Hayden around oral health care. And so only a third of Medicaid children 0 to 5 are receiving any dental or oral health care, mm-hmm. and only 26.7 receive preventative dental services. I'm taking that to be probably oral health assessment and maybe some education. So I'm wondering what plans you have to increase that, given that it's not on the metrics. The metrics, mm-hmm. incentive metrics for the CCOs are only on the sealants. What you're doing about that, and also whether you know offhand what the rate of women, prenatal women on Medicaid, both fee-for-service and in-network, are being seen for oral health, since the inflammation caused by their dental caries has huge right. impact on the fetus.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Representative Kenny Geyer, these are great questions. I will say the integration of dental health and oral health into the CCO model, the structure, has had its bumpy starts. It was sort of the third wave. Behavioral health came in first, and now oral health and the integration with the DCOs into the CCOs is starting to take hold in a better way. The bumpy start was recognized, and we spent some time this past fall and summer working on an integration plan. And we're happy to share that plan with you all to really help to jumpstart and facilitate that conversation. Part of some of the problems rest with data and data sharing. Some of it is with how can we track this. CCOs really hold a lot of the authority and can contract with lots of different DCOs. And so some of that data sharing would be more helpful if we could get it more streamlined so we can understand that in a better way. As far as your pregnant women question, I'm going to need to do a little bit of research on that. And thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Just one quick question. I've been waiting for 2 years for that plan. If it exists, where is it and why don't we have it?
Chair Lively and Representative Hayden, very good question. I'm not sure, and I can get back to you on that.
Okay. That's what I usually hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know how...
Is your name Bynum?
I called him Bynum first, but...
Sorry. You were looking at me.
Okay. He did not make a mistake.
Please.
I actually have a question about active play spaces. And one of the things we see in the urban centers is lack of active play space, lack of... transit routes to get there, safe transit routes. So can you talk about cities and community investments in the active play spaces, in sidewalks, and safe transportation routes?
Mm-hmm. Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, that's also a really great question. Those really are really strong social determinants that determine, that can really play into the health and well-being of our communities. We don't as directly relate with that, we do have a platform called Place Matters, and this is out of the chronic disease prevention section within the Public Health Division, and they're constantly working on creating communities where people live, play, and work that are support health. On that platform, there's testimonies and blogs and different kinds of stories throughout the community that talk about that. We also, every other year, have a conference where we bring together these different communities and try to figure out how we can move that forward. Mm-hmm.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kate, do we know how many CCOs have a council position for a DCO member, so that we are integrating that policy?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, I believe we can find that out. I believe we have the makeup of the different councils for each CCO. I know that there's a bill, I believe, going that will require that.
Okay.
And so...
I didn't know that. That was where I was headed.
Right.
Because... You know, with without that DCO presence on the council, my opinion, working with the CCO, I think that's part of the reason that it's been slow to be adopted. Mm-hmm. And it's critical for all the reasons we talked about, but also for the CCO to continue taking emergency room pressure off of the hospitals, because so many people come to the emergency room for oral health reasons. In child and adult population. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to make it happen.
I agree.
So I had a question regarding the shared metrics between CCOs and early learning, or the hubs. So I guess I'm just trying to understand, so what are we meeting the metrics combined, or what's the status of those?
Chair Lively, so the metrics development, and actually David should be speaking more to this than I probably, but as you know, the metrics have been developed for some time with the CCOs, and there are also hub metrics, and I know that David and his team are working on developing more of those, and what we're also trying to do is to cross-align them and working together so that where there are shared metrics, we can really collaborate in a much stronger way. There was an attempt a little bit ago with a joint subcommittee of the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Early Learning Council to look specifically at that. Mm-hmm. It's been on hiatus for a little bit, but that's sort of where that can happen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you very much.
Shows how complex this is and how many things overlap that regard to success. So. Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon Health Authority's early child health programs, nursing home visiting programs. And so now we're going to go back to House Bill 2643. And I open the public hearing on House Bill 2643. So, Zine, you want to give us the overview?
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. House Bill 2643 requires children under age 2 to be properly secured with a child safety system in a rear-facing position. There is a Dash 1 amendment that removes the 20-pound weight requirement. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement issued.
Okay, and Representative Malmstrom, would you like to offer some comments first?
Okay, well, we have some wonderful folks in the audience to give testimony, and I'm pretty much going to let them do that. But I will say one thing regarding this as an overview. In my 30-plus years of working with children and doing home visits, the most important thing when you're educating new parents about anything is to be consistent from the different groups that provide information, because when parents get conflicting information about what's best for their child, they're left to just make a random choice or just think that people just don't know any better and what have you. So it's really important that to me that we align, our laws with what the professional recommendations are. And you're going to hear from testimony about this. This is something that's been near and dear to my heart for many years. So I'm proud to bring this bill to.
Thank you for bringing the bill. So we have 6 people signed up to speak. And I don't know if there is an order that people prefer from presenting the information or not. Kevin Campbell. Oh, you are on the list. Excuse me.
Self-selection.
I'm so sorry.
If you'll just introduce yourselves for the record when you speak, please.
Indeed. So, Chairman Lively and members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time to hear this today. For the record, my name is Benjamin Hoffman. I'm a general pediatrician at OHSU. I'm also the medical director of the Tom Sargent Safety Center at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon Pediatric Society and Oregon Safe Kids. I've been certified as a child passenger safety, meaning car seat technicians, for almost 20 years, and I've been a technician instructor since 2001. I'm the only physician in the country who practices pediatrics who is certified as a technician instructor. I've worked with over 10,000 families to help them use their car seats correctly, and I'm also the chair-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Injury, Violence, and Poison Prevention, who is responsible for authoring the policy on car seat use in 2011.
Excuse me, Representative Huffman.
Dr. Hoffman, hate to slow you down, but I wondered if there was going to be a connection with oral health. It's a requirement of this committee. I respect that.
I'm going to save their teeth.
It turns out critically injured children do suffer from early childhood caries at a much greater rate.
Sealants help.
Appreciate that.
And if they crash,
having intact dentition is in fact a very good thing, and car seats can help support that, especially your rear-facing car seat. So, thank you very much. So, as you may know, motor vehicle crashes remain the leading cause of death for children over the age of 1. Approximately 5 kids per day in the United States are killed every single day, and approximately 350 children are injured seriously that require medical assistance. We know that using car safety seats can be an incredibly effective means for decreasing that risk. A car safety seat can decrease the risk of death for a child over the age of 1 by at least 54%, depending on the circumstances. Currently, Oregon actually has a quite good child passenger safety law. However, due to changes in best practice policy that have been driven by data, we now find ourselves in the position to improve that law to do good things for kids. In 2007, there was a study published that showed that kids between the age of 1 and 2 had a 5.32-fold decreased risk of injury if they were rear-facing compared to forward-facing. If you like statistics, 532%. It's hard to argue with that. As a result, the American Academy of Pediatrics revised our policy statement, and I was a co-author on that statement, to say, quote, all infants and toddlers should ride in a rear-facing car safety seat until they're 2 years old or until they reach the highest weight or height allowed by the manufacturer of the car safety seat. So if it's okay, I want to take just a second to help explain why rear-facing can be so much safer than forward-facing. Simply put, motor vehicle crashes involve a tremendous amount of energy. If you think about a 10-pound bowling ball, if I took a 10-pound bowling ball to a third-floor window and asked any of you to stand below and catch it, my guess is none of you would, because you're smart. The reason you wouldn't want to catch it is that by the time that bowling ball reaches your arms, it would represent approximately 330 pounds of momentum, of force. It would not end well for you or your arms. 10-pound baby, and as Representative Malmstrom is well as Representative Kenny Geyer, and anybody who's ever had a child, 10-pound baby could be at birth, but is most likely going to be certainly in the first 2 months of life. So we're talking about a very young, very small child. 30-mile-per-hour crash, low-speed crash. People do 30 miles per hour in the parking lot at Safeway all the time. Tiny baby, 30-mile-per-hour crash. That baby would represent 450 pounds of momentum. So that's 40% more than the bowling ball being dropped from a third-floor window. Now, physics tells us that we can't just make that energy disappear. And if you've got a baby who's moving at 30 miles per hour, that baby's going to continue moving at 30 miles per hour, or 40, or 50, or 60, or 80, until something stops them. If that something is a windshield or a tree, that doesn't end well. What we need to do is to be able to manage all of that energy in a way that's not going to impart injury to the human being. For us, wearing seatbelts, if we're in a crash, we're thrown forward into the seatbelt. The seatbelt contacts the strongest parts of our body, spreads the force over a fairly limited area, which is why a lot of people who are in high-speed crashes still sustain significant injuries. A car safety seat is specifically designed to do five things. Number one is it keeps the person in the vehicle, because it turns out you're about four times more likely to die if you're ejected. Number two, it spreads all the force of the crash over the widest possible surface area. And to explain why that, just to illustrate why that's so important, if you take a finger, and you don't have to do this, I'll do it for you. Take a finger and put it on your cheek and push, it hurts. But if I take my open palm and put it on my cheek and push with the same force, it does not, because I'm taking the same force and spreading it over a wider area. We need to make sure that force is spread over the parts of the body that can take it. And as any pediatrician will tell you, kids are not just small adults. And we have to think about kids differently because they have specifically different needs. We need to make sure that we protect the most vulnerable parts of the human body, which are basically the head, neck, and spinal cord, because we can fix most other parts. Those parts we're not very good at fixing. So if I can just show you briefly, if it's all right, with this car safety seat, and I will tell you that this doll represents a child of about 18 months. If the vehicle was moving in this direction and the child was properly equipped or properly positioned in the seat, as the car at impact, all of the child's momentum is in this direction, and so the child gets pushed into the seat, spreading the force of the crash literally from head to toe, which is the widest possible surface area you could possibly do it. The harness on the seat is contacting the child over the shoulders and over three points over the pelvis on both sides and in the center, which spreads the forces over a much wider surface area on the front than your three-point seatbelt does. The seat is also designed to flex and bend and rotate, and that helps absorb some of the energy, as well as enabling the child to take advantage of a lot of the newer safety mechanisms built into vehicles, including crumple zones and those sorts of things. So simply put, there is no safer way to travel in a car than rear-facing.
Very safe.
excuse me. So, and I have a photo here that I can pass around if you'd like that illustrates what happens in a simulated crash with a dummy in terms of the head and spinal cord rear facing compared to what happens forward facing. May I bring this up? We know that common sense and evidence-based laws are by far the most effective way to change people's behaviors around injury prevention. And we've seen this in the passage of booster seat laws. In every place where a booster seat law has been passed and it's been studied, kids have been protected, fewer injuries, fewer deaths. As of January of this year, 4 states have already passed laws that require rear-facing tilt 2. I'm aware presently of 5 other states in addition to Oregon that have already submitted bills to their state houses, and I'm certain there will be a number of others. Just to address what I think is the most common concern that we frequently hear from parents and also from concerned citizens about rear facing longer, and that has to do with the comfort and positioning of the child. So I want to share a couple of things with you. First of all, since we're doing this based on science, understanding how kids grow is absolutely essential. And so these are growth charts that come from the United States Centers for Disease Control. These are produced in 2000 and are based on a representative sample of children from across a bunch of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. The average child at age 2, at least the average boy at age 2, is going to weigh somewhere between 24 pounds and 34 pounds and have a length of somewhere between 34 inches and about 38 inches. Car seat manufacturers over the last 4 or 5 years, especially in response to the American Academy of Pediatrics policy change, have really done amazing things with the products that they're producing for the public in terms of accommodating children to longer lengths and higher weights. And we're at a place in time that there's essentially no kid. I'm sure there's one, but there are essentially no kids that would not be able to ride rear-facing in a car safety seat until their second birthday. I want to share with you also a picture of the children of 2 colleagues of mine. This is Trustin, who at this point was 3.5 years old, 36 pounds and 32 inches. And then this is Alyssa and her sister Phoebe. Alyssa's 4. Phoebe's 1, rear-facing. It can be done. The point of this law is not to punish families, but to help establish new norms for behavior. We know that while the law of the land can change, the laws of physics never do. And we need to be conscious of that to be able to protect kids in the greatest possible way. Our hope is that by establishing this law, it will help change behavior, again, not through punishment, but through education and sort of establishing what best practice is. Because as some of my colleagues are going to tell you, as a practicing pediatrician, many families, and as a car seat technician who spends countless weekend hours in parking lots helping families, people assume that the law is what they should be doing. And I think we can do better. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you very much.
Chair Lively and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to join the Oregon Health Sciences University and the broader medical community in supporting this change to law. I think just to the point that you just made, law enforcement enforces the law that's in place, not the law we think should be in place. I think pediatricians have been probably telling their patients for some time that a rear-facing seat up to the age of 2 is a good idea. But law enforcement, we're enforcing the 1 year. It's clear that best practice now, the research demonstrates where the law really should be. And so we're anxious to support this change if your committee decides to send this forward. For our police officers and deputy sheriffs, they often see the sad end of these situations, and as Representative Peluso would understand because of her history, these are obviously tragic. They're also very traumatic to everybody, including the officers that have to respond. These can be career-long incidents for them that cause them trouble and difficulty, and so anything we can do to avoid these worst-case scenarios, we're very supportive of. And we're also supportive where research tells us that there's a standard that will improve child safety, we're eager to support amendments to the law. Now, from an enforcement perspective, this isn't a difficult law for us to enforce. I mean, in essence, it will require us to do very little different than we already do. I do want to say that our officers, who many are also trained as technicians, take their role as educators very seriously in this regard, and they far prefer to spend their time doing seatbelt clinics designed to help parents understand the law and to help them make sure they're installing their car seats properly so that not only the seat is safe, but the installation is safe as well. And so for that reason, I just strongly support this bill on behalf of the chiefs and sheriffs, and appreciate the opportunity to come before a committee that I don't often get to come in front of, and it's a pleasure. So thank you for letting me come up and testify today.
Thank you, Kevin. You're always welcome to come back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and the committee. My name for the record is Kimberly Ruscher. I'm a pediatric surgeon, so a little different background than the rest of the medical community represented here today. And I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Surgeons today and as a mother of two who's been through this policy change in the last couple of years. I would emphasize greatly the importance of this recommendation in terms of the safety of children in the mechanics of a car accident. It's very easy to see by looking at that visual example how a child is safer rear facing. And I have heard a lot of moms, as the mom of a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, argue with me about why this is a wrong recommendation. And the specific arguments I heard over the years have been, I can't see my kid because they're rear facing. I don't know if they're throwing up. I don't know if they're breathing because I can't hear them talking to me. It's really hard to get the car seats in, and man, do I know that, right? Having said that, I see the other end of it. Nobody ever wants to meet me. I went into a job where I want to save kids' lives. I love children. I like kids better than adults, usually. But I would really be happy to just take care of kids with appendicitis and things that aren't preventable for the rest of my hopefully long career. So my argument to those mothers, I don't want to scare anybody, but I always say there are a lot of choices we can make, and I value independence in decision-making and parenting. My parenting style is not the same as my neighbor's, is not the same as my sister's, and I think that autonomy is important, both with regard to this specific issue. I don't think education is enough of the community. I don't think that accessibility is enough. We have access to car seats that are made for children to be comfortable. You can go to Walmart and buy well-made car seats where kids are going to be comfortable. There's education out there because of the work of the AAP. But this little extra bit, I really believe, is needed to provide that push to keep kids safer longer. Because seeing me in the trauma room is horrifying. It's horrifying, as you alluded to, for the providers, and it's even more horrifying for the families. Being in that room as a trauma provider, it's hot. Kids get, when they get cold, they don't do as well. They get more infections, more complications. It's noisy. It's scary. You know, that kid on that table might be the same as your 5-year-old, same birthday or same size. I never want to see that again. And if we can prevent all those cases in Oregon where a kid gets injured and has to see somebody like me, let's do it. In terms of as an injury prevention strategy, I want to just reiterate something that I think I can speak to. I'm very young in my career in trying to do injury prevention. Hopefully someday I'll have the history that Dr. Hoffman has. But I do injury prevention talks on a lot of topics, and I think for some of them, education is plenty. A great example is button batteries, the little round batteries that are in remotes. Mm-hmm. Moms are all over that. I had a mom come over for a play date, and she looked around my living room to make sure my remote controls are elevated. We don't need any laws about that, right? Parents are making informed choices. We have safer packaging. Parents know about it. We're doing better. But this specifically, I think, merits additional consideration for passage. This is broadly supported by the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Chapter of the American College of Surgeons, Oregon Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, of course, the Pediatric Society. And I thank you for allowing me to testify. I hope to never have to take care of these patients again. And if I can provide any additional information from a trauma or injury prevention perspective, I would offer my services.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for testifying.
Chair, can I have one quick question?
Oh, sure. What's in the binding?
So one spring break, I let my mother-in-law take all the kids, and I got the kids back, and I said, what was the best part of your spring break? And one of them says, Grandma let us ride without a seatbelt. So does this apply to grandparents and the plan?
Whoever's driving.
I think that's a great question. I am not a perfect mother, and my mother frequently reminds me how when she did things when I was growing up and I still survived, my kids are going to be okay if she takes care of them for a day. So my mom is going to continue to try and feed my little kids pieces of hot dogs and grapes that she shouldn't. I'm going to continue to yell it back at her. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's a great question. It should apply to anyone who's carrying a child.
Yep. So I guess I'm just lightheartedly suggesting that grandparents be a part of the education plan that we're proposing. Yeah.
Definitely. Representative Bynum, I know the American Academy of Pediatrics has done an increasing amount of work with the AARP I got my card this year. Yeah. Spirit of full disclosure. to help make those connections, because it's much broader than that. Kids, you know, in the United States today, kids are not, they spend a lot of time out of the care of their direct mm-hmm. parent or primary caregiver, mm-hmm. Whether it's child care, kinship care, grandparents, et cetera. That's an absolutely essential point.
Okay. Representative Lively and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Angela Zallin. I'm a community pediatrician in Eugene. I'm also a car seat technician, the vice chair of Safe Kids West Oregon, and a mom to an 11-month-old. Mm. I just want to give my perspective a little bit. As a community pediatrician, I talk about car seat safety at every single well checkup, including the newborn one. And I always recommend rear facing as long as possible. What I have seen is, you know, there's a difference between education, and we can do a lot of education for our families, and what the law says also bears a lot of credence to what decision they make. The recommendations by the American Academy of Pediatrics has been rear-facing until at least two or as long as possible for quite some time now, but I think it takes a long time for these things to take hold and change behavior. It's difficult sometimes for me to convince a family of the importance of rear-facing their child as long as possible, because either they see it as unnecessary or, you know, the law says 1 in 20 pounds, so that must mean that that's okay to do. In fact, I recently had a family who were not aware of the law, and they turned their baby forward facing at 9 months of age. Mm. When I had that discussion with them about what the law is and what best practices are, they promptly turned their baby back around. But I think, you know, we do a lot of education in my field, but having the law on my side as an argument point can be really, really helpful in changing that behavior. We know that kids who are kept rear-facing until two are safer and experience less severe injury and death in all crash types than those that are forward-facing. The evidence supports this bill, and I just implore you as a pediatrician, as a mom, to use the most current science and keep our kids safe. Additionally, we have some testimony from a family from Myrtle Creek, John Cole and Tanya Stinson, who are unable to be here today, but they wanted to share their story with you. There's written testimony of their entire story, but I just wanted to take this chance to share a part of their testimony with you. John and Tanya's son, Lucas, suffered a critical injury to his spinal cord while traveling in a forward-facing car seat a couple days before his third birthday. And as I said, their entire story is written, but the main point that they wanted me to make sure that I had a chance to convey to the committee is this. They said, the message that we want to leave you with is that every child deserves the chance to be their best, and you never know when anyone could have an accident. You can be the safest parent in the world, but you never know if someone else will make a mistake. Lucas was 3 years old, and we know that if we had been aware of how much a difference rear-facing could make, we would have done it. Changing the law to require rear-facing until two will help protect precious lives. How many two-year-olds know the difference between riding forward and backwards? The parents are the ones who push it. There's lack of knowledge out there for all the parents. We thought Lucas was safe. Lucas's whole life has changed. If this law helps parents learn how to better protect their kids, then maybe other children won't have to suffer like Lucas has. We can tell you that if we had known, he would have been rear-facing still, and he could have blown out his candles on his third birthday.
Thank you. So that letter is on OLS tubuses, but I think you have copies of it there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all very much. So I appreciate it. Oh, just a minute. Representative Hayden. Sorry.
Here you go.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I'd like to present an option here or hope for an amendment on this bill. I understand I've got three little kids. I got a one-year-old, six-year-old, seven-year-old, raised other children. Very important to keep them as safe as possible. But there is an argument that we don't give the parents whiplash on what we do with these laws. And so, you know, we've got programs out there in hospitals. We've got nonprofit programs out there providing car seats for infants, infant seats, and that technology is developing. But they can pay $30 or so is kind of the standard to get an infant seat. And so you've got, without some sort of integration or some education time, and my recommendation is 12 months of non-penalty to integrate this from a police force standpoint. And so that parents have the time to adjust to it, for the education to get out there. You know, so if you got a 11-month-old, you know, by the time that is a two-year-old, well, now you're forced with a ticket, right? Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you're being educated on the need to do that. And the police officer is saying, hey, you really need to do this. I'm going to give you a warning, you know, to whoever. So I think there's an importance to respect the general public on what we've said. The national best practice recommendations, according to our website, which has the NHTSA.gov website, which lists this, our current laws fall within that recommendation. Now, so parents are not treating their children at risk according to the current standard recommendation. We're pushing above that. And that's okay to push above that. We want our kids in Oregon to be as safe as possible. But if you're meeting the current national standard of best practice and then saying to parents, if you don't step above that, we're going to penalize you immediately, I'm opposed to that, right? I think if our laws currently meet that best practices and we have a better option, that we need to give parents the, you know, the opportunity to figure it out without being threatened with a ticket. So I would like to see an amendment that says we've got a 12-month warning, kind of like they did with cell phones. You know, maybe they didn't, you know, when we have cell phones and hands-free and stuff, police officers maybe could have, but they gave me a few warnings anyway. You know, so a warning phase to this, something that parents can be informed on it, that the hospitals can adjust for their low-income car seats because you got an infant seat there that you know, may not be appropriate to. Now, he's saying that they all are. Okay, great. But I think there needs to be a time for parents to be able to adjust to it so that they're not feeling, well, I'm threatened with a ticket today if I don't do this.
Well, Chair Lively and Representative Hayden, you know, we're not the sponsor of the bill, but on behalf of the chiefs and the sheriffs, I think I can say with confidence that that isn't a problem in my mind at all. I think likely officers today, what they're not as concerned about issuing tickets on this. It really is about public safety, and that is an educational role. I think officers more and more are viewing these kind of things from an educational standpoint. They're very likely to let people know, but I don't have a problem if the sponsors don't have a problem with some provision that delays that penalty.
The penalty phase, yeah. Yes. That's what I would look for in it.
Okay, Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you very much. First of all, I strongly support the bill. Thank you, Representative Malmstrom, for bringing it forward. I went to a CDC Winnable Battles conference with Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, and Representative Stark in Denver in June. And this is one of the seven winnable battles that CDC has. And I'm just going to there since you brought up the other recommendations. So I went, did I remember that wrong? Indeed, it is birth to age two for rear facing. So I support it. I did have some similar questions about the transition time if somebody has already switched to to a front facing and they're between age 1 and 2, I think some kind of grace period. You've got the misdemeanor or parking violation class D, I think, right now. You know, some kind of grace period I think would be appropriate, but overall I strongly support the bill.
Anything else? Representative Peluso.
Thanks, Chair Lively. Again, I'm going back to law enforcement days. We can do a grace period. We would frequently do that when we put out a new traffic signal or whatever. But by golly, if that's the time an accident occurs, there's going to be a lot of guilty feelings and what ifs and I should have. And I'm just very grateful sitting here today with a 24-year-old daughter who survived the car seat she had. Yeah. So thank you for what you do. But I tell you, there is a... You don't want to go to one of those scenes. You don't want to be a part of it. And if there have always within the communities been an opportunity to get a free car seat if needed, that those programs go on forever and ever. The day I put my child into that car seat after she, I was taking her home from the hospital is when I needed to be up to speed. And then you get up to speed. So thank you for what you're doing. It's amazing. And you're preventing a lot of hardships. So thank you.
Did you have something for that?
Thank you. I did have one other question, especially if there were to be an amendment about a grace period at all. You've changed the age from 1 to 2, but you didn't change the pounds. Right now it's up to 20 pounds. You said most 2-year-olds are between 24 and 34. And I wonder if we're going to pass a bill, and what do other states do? But it's also not clear whether it's which comes first or which comes second.
So I can answer that, Representative Kenny Geyer. So that we actually did work with Representative Malmstrom and remove the 20 pounds, any reference to weight, because the intent...
still in the...
I think in the revision, it's not. Yeah.
There's an amendment.
I apologize for that. Initially, our request, we had... All the other states have either implemented a 30 or 40-pound limit in addition to that. We felt like if you look at growth charts and anatomically and physiologically what happens to kids, there's really no reason to have a weight limit. It makes most sense to have an age limit. And so that was left in, I think... inadvertently, and Representative Malmstrom was responsive enough to help us get that changed.
Thank you.
You also need the car manufacturer time to put a screen on the back of the seat.
some are doing that.
Hey, that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
I got three little kids.
Yeah. So we have two more people that would like to testify, so if we could give them an opportunity. I understand that. Yeah. So, Hans, too.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Nye. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm a mom of a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. My 4-year-old's car seat remained rear-facing until he was 3.5 years old. And my 2-year-old is still rear-facing. And thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of HB 2643. And thank you to Rep. Malmstrom for introducing this bill on this important issue. As a parent, I want what is best for my kids, and I take their safety very seriously. And as a nurse, I am guided by evidence-based practice, and I understand the importance of having laws and policies that reflect safety standards recommended by experts. The evidence for extended rear-facing car seats is clear, and it was mentioned before, but it bears reiterating that there are many peer-reviewed studies that have demonstrated that rear-facing car seats are significantly safer for children 2 and under, and those studies demonstrate that children are 75% less likely to die in a car crash while rear-facing and are 5 times safer than children who are forward-facing. And we have a responsibility to keep Oregon's children safe. So please support the passage of HB 2643. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for being here for testimony. So.
Thank you, Chair Lively. My name is Hans Notenboom. I represent the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I'm the president of the Oregon chapter. I'm a physician in the emergency department down in Eugene for the past 17 years. We have submitted a written testimony, so I'll try to keep my comments brief. You can refer to that. But in general, we support this bill in that we support evidence-based science that says that this is safer for our children. As was said earlier, I would agree. One of my favorite lines is kids are not just small adults, and the physics are really clear when you talk about small children compared to adults. For example, you know, the percentage of body mass in a small child in the head can be up to 25%, where it might only be 6% in adults. And when you start talking about these deceleration injuries and the surface area discussion that we already saw with this great demonstration, you can see how that's a big deal. In the emergency department, our professional group in this state has been present since 1971. We like to think that we're experts in accident, acute injury, and trauma, but we also across the country see about 30 million pediatric visits over the course of the year. So we are definitely committed to this cause. We definitely see the unfortunate effects of when things like this could be preventable. And I would agree with Dr. Ruscher. This is not a great place to be. These are the worst cases that we have that stick with us, not just for our career, but for our whole lives. This is something that we can change and we can improve. And in addition to that, I think that laws like this sometimes people perceive as this is punitive, this is a ticket, but this is how we change the culture. And the actual ticket writing itself isn't necessarily the thing. I would point to cars or seatbelts, for example. I think now kids today, at least my kids, I have four kids, you just put the seatbelt on. Everyone knows that. When I was a kid, it was kind of a, should I put the seatbelt on? Can I have it on? It was a discussion. That's not even a thought process today. Now, that's not because my family got a slew of tickets. That's just because that's the culture now. And this is one step towards that. So with that, we would strongly support this, and I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions members have of these two witnesses? Okay.
Thank you.
Again, thank you very much for being here. So is there anybody else wishing to testify on this? No. I'm going to close the public hearing. And it appears there's a question, and I'll refer that back to you as the sponsor of the bill if you want to pursue possibly talking about an amendment or not before we move the bill. We have the amendment that changed the weight, but there was some question about
whether there would be a ticket associated. I'm fine with that as long as the law goes forward, as planned. It was never my intention to make a punitive thing out of this. It's an education thing, and so I'm fine with that.
I have a question for that be, if there was an amendment to give a grace period of 12 months, would that be written into this bill or would it be written into a different statute for public safety?
You could deal with this.
Right.
Okay. So we'll let you have that conversation and that then if maybe Kevin can help or whoever else can help.
May I make one brief comment, Chair Lively? There are a number of municipalities around the state that have forgiveness programs for families who are given a ticket for child restraint, non-use or misuse, that allow them to interact with the child passenger safety technician, learn how to do things correctly, and then have their ticket waived. And I think that those supporting those things in addition to, and it's a common sense approach to education, and because we know that the law is what drives best practice behaviors, having the force of the law behind it is huge. Mm-hmm. The idea of not punishing people, I'm with you 100%.
So why don't you have those conversations in the, when you're comfortable, if either takes an amendment or right, Representative Malmstrom will move the bill for you. But
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I would move to make that amendment.
Thank you. Any other
I second her move.
Representative Huffman's as helpful as he can be.
Yeah.
Okay, if there's no other business, we'll adjourn.
Have a good day.
No other business, we'll adjourn.